What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Well, it's another scintillating episode of AmericaTrendsPodcast.com, and your co-pilots welcome you with more flair and greater courtesy than any of the other airlines. I'm Larry Rifkin, and playing Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in the co-pilot seat, my friend John Krofcik. Did you like those airplane movies?
Yeah, those were funny.
They were
very funny, yeah.
Yeah, they were.
Those were great.
Well, Johnny the K, as he's affectionately known. And Johnny, we're cooking today.
We are cooking.
I'm looking at this temperature on the wall. And in our studio, in the America Trends podcast studio, courtesy of our good friends at 1320 WATR. And we want to give them a plug. It's 111 degrees.
Yeah, that's a hot roof.
Wow. Well, turn me over. I'm done on this side, John. All right. Well, as a keen listener, and I know that you are, the person to whom we are speaking, you know that we have begun to focus on this invisible tragedy of working age men who are out of the workforce. And John, we've done a lot of interesting work on this already, haven't we?
We sure have. It's really discouraging when you hear these numbers that people give and all. It's really bad.
We've got a lot of men, over 7 million, who are out of the workforce, ages 25 to 54. They're not starting productive lives, or they're starting them much later, contributing nothing really at the moment to the economy. And in many ways, they are contributing to some of the societal ills that we do have, people who are really in despair. And a lot of those diseases and conditions like opioid use, obesity, lots of unhealthy lifestyles.
We need jobs.
We do.
We need jobs bad.
And meaningful jobs.
Meaningful
where
jobs,
you can start
yes.
a life, start a family.
Absolutely.
And it's not funny business. It really isn't. And John and I know that. And to illustrate the tragedy that really does cast a pall over a community when men and women, for that matter, are benched economically and pushed to the sidelines, we turn in this episode, and this is part of a three-part series that we've been doing about men out of work, to a woman, John, by the name of Amy Goldstein. And she is the author of this compelling new book entitled Janesville, An American Story. And Janesville, does that ring any bells to you?
No, off the top of my head.
Oh, no. It would.
It would.
I'm going to take you back to 2012.
Okay.
And we saw a very young guy, very vibrant, who was picked by Mitt Romney to be his vice presidential candidate. And he was from a Midwestern city of about 68,000 people. And his name, of course, Paul Ryan.
Paul Ryan.
Now yes. The Speaker of the House.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. And he is a character in this book.
He's from Janesville.
He's from Janesville.
All right.
Absolutely. Janesville was the home of Parker Penn. It's got a long industrial history. And GM, their oldest plant, was in Janesville. Their oldest plant.
Right. Didn't they try to keep the plant there or something?
They were trying very hard, but they were making the SUVs.
That's right. I remember now.
And he's part of this drama where he gets on the phone with the president, Mr. Wagner. Hey, you know, what's going on here? I can't believe you're going to do this. You're going to kill this community. And can't you make something else here? Can't you make... small cars or whatever. I mean, can't you do something? Trucks are still big. And no, we're closing it down.
Sad.
And it was 2 days before Christmas.
Yeah.
I mean, the year that they
story.
Did it.
Yep.
Yeah. That's Janesville. And that's the story that she tells. And Amy Goldstein, she shared a Pulitzer Prize with other reporters of the Washington Post several years back and really knows how to tell a story. And that's the compelling thing about this story, because what she's able to tell us, and I'm not going to give it all away, John.
All right, don't.
But whenever this happens.
Amy can tell us.
The entire, she will. The entire community is affected. And I want to bring that back to your doorstep, John, because you and I live in a community where we weren't a one industry town. Well, we were a one industry town, but we had a lot of companies.
Right, right. The brass industry.
Right. But they were all in the same
right
complex. Scoville, Anaconda, yep. American Brass. Yep. But they supported the rest of the entire community.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, wow. They were the ones who populated the boards of nonprofit organizations. They were the ones, for example, John and I come out of a tradition here in this city, which is a little bit larger than Janesville, of over 100,000 people. And they supported three or more radio stations at one time.
Wow.
In this community.
Wow.
When you think about it.
I didn't realize that.
Well,
there was QQ.
QQQW, WWCO, WATR, and then we had two FMs, one that was in Prospect one that WATR owned. So, I mean, they went broader than this community. But let's say there were, three and a half or four radio stations.
Wow.
And now, really, in effect, this community supports one radio station. So the impacts of these industries, well, we've done a show called Manufacturing Matters. And what was it that they said? That it was a multiplier effect of 3 to 4 to 5, jobs
right
for everyone in industry.
Right. It's crazy.
So Janesville, this story tells us of all of the impacts that this has had on everything, from the educational system and what you can afford to spend on it, to all the nonprofits and what they're able to do in the community, to many other supportive businesses, whether it's a diner, whatever it may be. And she tells a really tragic story about Janesville.
Wow.
But Janesville is really just a symbol for many other communities across America.
Absolutely. Well, that's how we got Donald Trump, because many people are out of work and they're looking for hope.
Absolutely. And we've got to be discerning, because a lot of people can come and they can have all the right buzzwords about what's wrong, but do they have the solutions?
Absolutely. And that's the problem.
And they can take advantage of our weakness at this time, because we're looking for hope and basically we think everyone else has forgotten about us. But what happens in these communities, John, and we've seen it in our own community. I mean, what do we have? We've got a lot of burned out factories. We've got a lot of brown fields. We've got lots of attempts to restore that, but it takes all kinds of money, and many people are unwilling to put the money in and risk it all when they have so many liabilities on their books to start with in terms of just the environmental conditions.
Absolutely. Plus the taxes go up because you don't have the businesses, so people are paying taxes, and now then you got people leaving because they can't afford that. I mean, it's just a downward spiral.
Well, in this book, you're right. I mean, they talk about the Janesville gypsies, and these are people who during the week would have to go literally away from their homes. In certain cases, for the year, they'd have to go down to Houston or wherever the jobs were, and they'd send money back. But that means total dislocation for a family.
Right.
So many impacts that I don't think we put together.
No, but you don't.
She's done that, and it's a drama. I mean, it really is. If the name sounds familiar, again, Janesville, GM plant, the first one ever in America, and then, of course, the home of Paul Ryan. Well, let's look at the tragedy through the eyes of Amy Goldstein and the response from the inside, and she will share with us the way that certain people in that community responded. And they are heroes, John, people who hung in and stuck it out. And they're coming back a bit, but not the same.
We need a big boost, but let's let Amy tell us about this.
All right. We're going to be talking about Janesville, an American story. And is Janesville, Amy, really a metaphor for what has gone on in America in so many places?
Well, that was the whole reason I set out to do this work. I had the sense that, a few years ago, as the Great Recession was ending or recently ended, we sort of knew that the unemployment rate still wasn't good, and we knew that there was a lot of anxiety among American voters even back then about the political system and whether the government's economic policies were helping or not. But we didn't really know, as a country, what it felt like to lose work. Communities knew, but it sort of wasn't part of the kind of national consciousness to be talking about what really happens when jobs go away. And as you say, this is something that's happened in many parts of the country, and my idea was to take a look at one community close up to see what really happens to people and to the texture of a proud community when the best of its work vanishes.
As a great journalist, do you have expectations as to what story you are going to find, and were you surprised by the way the community responded?
That's a good question. You know, I thought a lot about what community I was going to pick. I mean, as I sometimes think, if you're going to write about something in microcosm, you better be pretty careful about what you choose to look at. And I knew certain things about Janesville when I got started. I knew that it had lost a lot of jobs between 2008 and 2009. The county that Janesville is the county seat for had lost about 9,000 jobs, so a lot of work went away. I knew that the kind of jobs that had vanished were typical of the kind of work that went away nationally during the Great Recession, a lot of manufacturing jobs, more men than women had lost work. A lot of the jobs that disappeared were ones that had paid fairly well but didn't require a lot of higher education to get. I also knew that there was probably going to be something kind of interesting to find politically in a community that was an old United Auto Workers town represented in Congress by Paul Ryan and the state governed by Scott Walker. So these were things that I could know up front. What I didn't really know before I started getting to know people in town and spending years going back and forth there to learn about what was happening to people was just how resilient this community was. I mean, they tried, and they have tried, and are still trying pretty much everything you can to try to get jobs to come back. That doesn't mean it's easy. But I was really struck by the sort of ingenuity and determination of people there.
Well, you write that if Parker Penn put Janesville on the map, GM kept it there. So was there something in their DNA that you could tell that this was a resourceful community that would in some way rebound?
Well, what I could tell was that there were these local iconic industrialists. Georges Parker had founded the Parker Penn Company, as you say, in the late 1880s. He was a telegraphy instructor and had students with leaky fountain pens, and he was determined to make a better one and built an international company out of this by the beginning of the 20th century. And there was another guy named Joseph Craig, who had been the top manager at a local farm implements manufacturer. And he was the person who persuaded the then head of General Motors to bring General Motors to Janesville. So I knew that there was a sort of local resilience and resourcefulness and sort of industrial pride mm-hmm. at what these two men had built for the local economy. And, you know, not everybody thinks all the time about these two men, but I think that there's something about this kind of, you know, these founding industrial myths of Janesville that really do seep into the culture there.
You have a cast of characters that you put in the opening to the book. And for a nonfiction work, some would find that surprising. You start with the auto workers and their families, the other workers, the politicians, the educators, the business leaders, the community leaders. What were you trying to say by singling them out?
Well, the idea that I had was I wanted this to feel like a kaleidoscope. So that you were seeing what the experience of work disappearing and trying to figure out what to do about it, what that experience was like from people with different vantage points in town. Because, you know, the point was that it wasn't just the, you know, few thousand auto workers at General Motors or the people who had lost work at supplier companies that were making things for this auto plant or the people who had run little restaurants or daycare centers that couldn't keep going when so many other people lost jobs and lost income. But there were all kinds of people in town who were affected by this enormous job loss and who were trying to figure out what to do. So I wanted to show, you know, from these various perspectives, what people thought they ought to try to do about this.
You do express the fact that retail stores, of course, would lose customers, public schools would lose tax dollars, retraining programs would become overwhelmed. Was there any spillover effect that you never even imagined that you thought was so far away from the impact of this, and yet it was affected directly?
Well, one of the things that I was really struck by was the effect on school kids. There were a lot of, I mean, this is a town that had, you know, some poor families all along. It wasn't a poor place, but like any community, it had people who were more or less well off. But there were a number of families, lots of families, that had been middle class, and they weren't anymore. And I wanted to get to know at least some of these families. There's one that I write about in depth in the book. And what really struck me was that even though this is happening to lots and lots of families, this was not something that teenagers talked about with one another. It was something that was very private. So you had all these stressed out kids and stressed out parents who were trying to kind of keep up appearances as best they could. And I found that very poignant.
You also, of course, expressed the fact that there were many Janesville gypsies. Explain what that means.
Well, when the General Motors assembly plant was going, it really had the best pay and the best benefits of any working class jobs in town. General Motors was paying at the end $28 an hour, and there was a lot of overtime. And even when all this work went away, you were still a little better off if you had been a GMer. And the way in which you were better off was that at first you got what was called subpay, union kind of extra unemployment benefits on top of regular unemployment benefits. But you had this other advantage, too, if you wanted to take it, which was that you had transfer rights to other General Motors plants around the country that were still making things. So there were a number of people in Janesville who decided that they couldn't find any kind of job that paid anything like what they'd been earning at General Motors, who made these very hard choices to begin commuting the plants elsewhere. I follow a family closely in which the guy who had been working for 13 years at General Motors in Janesville starts to commute on a weekly basis to Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Mm.
That was a close place. Other people were working in Arlington, Texas. So these were long commutes. And it was really telling about people's rootedness in town because they could have had their families move, but they didn't want to. They thought, well, they would make the sacrifice and let their family life stay where it's always been.
Now, you looked at this cast of characters over the course of 5 years, from 2008 to 2013, and then you have an epilogue that concludes in the present, when unemployment right now is less than 4%. So is everything back to normal in Janesville?
Well, I think the definition of normal has changed, as it has in many places in this country. You know, as you say, if you look just at the unemployment rate, things look much better. I mean, in the early spring of 2009, a few months after all this work began to go away, the unemployment rate in Janesville's county was over 13%. As you say, now it's under 5%. So just by that number, it looks a lot better. But if you look at the kinds of jobs people are having and, for the most part, what those jobs are paying, it's nothing like it used to be.
You say that the town now has an optimism gap. You've got all these dispossessed workers on the one hand, and yet people who, through the Chamber of Commerce and other entities, are getting bullish on the community. Is there a dissonance between the leadership and what the real lives of people on the ground are?
Well, I think everybody sees things through their own prism, and not everybody in town was hurt. And for the people who've been trying very assertively to rebuild the local economy as best they can, you know, it's kind of a selling point to be talking about how good Janesville's economy is. And, you know, there are some data, as you said, the unemployment rate itself is way down, that they can legitimately cite. But that's not the perspective of people who are now working much worse jobs than they ever had, or sometimes working two jobs to try to keep their family going, or are commuting hundreds of miles away. I mean, they're just people having different experiences.
Did you go back yourself as a working journalist, not working on this book any longer, to see what impact the 2016 election had on the people of Janesville?
Well, you can imagine that the morning after the election, I raced to my computer to see what had happened.
Yes.
Because Wisconsin, for the first time in many years, as a whole, voted Republican in 2016. It voted for now President Trump. But that wasn't true in Janesville or Rock County, where Janesville is located. This is, as I said, this is an old UAW town. It's a pretty Democratic part of the state. And what I found fascinating was that in 2012, 62% of the electorate in that county voted for the reelection of Barack Obama. In 2016, 52% voted for Hillary Clinton. So it stayed Democratic, but by the much much slimmer margin. And if you look at the raw numbers, it turns out that it wasn't that there was a lot of switching of Democratic voters to Republican voters. There was almost no increase in the number of Republican votes cast, but the Democratic turnout was significantly down.
And yet in 2012, they had their own golden guy, Paul Ryan, on the ticket.
That's exactly right. I mean, Paul Ryan, as he says frequently, he's fifth generation Janesville. I mean, he comes from an old family in town, one of three big, sprawling Irish families that were involved in kind of the building trades, generations back, and are still all over the community. So, I mean, this is his place. I mean, he went to high school with, you know, men and women now who lost their jobs. I mean, he knows very personally what this meant. And, you know, what I've learned over time is that people in Janesville tend to, at least, you know, up until lately when things have been getting more and more politically polarized in Janesville and around the country, you know, for a long time people in Janesville thought that Paul Ryan was, you know, a decent man, a hard working man, but they tended to dislike his conservative views.
And yet in your book, I don't think that either he or Barack Obama come out terribly well. I mean, we now know that a lot of people are turning to the Republican Party as the salvation of the working man, even though some would question in other books, Thomas Frank in What's the Matter with Kansas, whether in fact a lot of these workers are voting their economic interests. So how do you look at the leadership and the way people responded to them in the wake of this tragic loss of GM?
Well, I think that, you know, whether you're talking about Republicans or Democrats, you know, people in this community have been looking for solutions. And, you know, my book is not a political polemic,
right,
in, you know, in any way. I mean, my whole point in researching this for years and writing it was just to really try to show in a visceral way what it's like for a community to lose its best work. But that said, I mean, I think that, you know, what I've seen in this one community makes pretty clear that many of the ideas that are widely espoused for trying to help communities when work goes away don't work very well. And, you know, it's true of Republican ideas and Democratic ideas. I mean, just to give you one example, you know, one of the sort of remedies that's widely prescribed for people who lose work is to do job retraining.
We hear this all the time.
Absolutely. And it's one of the few economic policies that conservatives and liberals, people all across the ideological spectrum, tend to think is a good idea. And I was very interested in looking at this on the ground in Janesville. I mean, I figured if part of what I was interested in looking at was what happens when work goes away, question of what do you do next and can job retraining help was sort of the next obvious question. So not only did I interview a lot of people both at this technical college in town called Blackhawk Technical College that inherited about 2,000 dislocated workers over a couple of years, as you say at the outset, it was just slammed with people racing back to school. But I also took a look statistically at what happened with help of a couple of good labor economists who helped me do this research. And we looked at people in this part of southern Wisconsin who had and had not retrained, but had all lost their jobs around this time of the Great Recession, 2008, 2009, maybe a little bit, 2007. And the results were quite striking. It turned out that people who retrained didn't fare as well on balance. I mean, not that nobody did okay. I mean, I know people who did very well out of going back to school, but on balance, the people who retrained were less likely a few years later to be working all four quarters of the year. And if you look at their pay before the recession and a few years afterwards, they weren't doing as well compared to people who hadn't gone back to school.
That seems counterintuitive, but do you have any thoughts about that?
It does seem counterintuitive, and, you know, believe me, I've thought a lot and talked with a lot of people about why this might be the case, and the numbers themselves don't provide the answers, but I think there are a couple of possibilities. One is that it's possible that people who could get work after they'd lost a job took it, and other people waited a while and went back to school. So that might be part of it. Another part might be that people who retrained, even the ones who succeeded in graduating, which was a minority of the people who went back to school, most people didn't finish their academic programs. But those who did, if they succeeded in finding a job in the field that they had trained for, were starting out at the bottom of the ladder, so they were not making much money. And, you know, it'd be interesting to see over time if the gap between those who retrained and those who didn't has narrowed. I don't have those data, but I'd be fascinated to see them. But I think perhaps the biggest factor is that this college tried really hard to help people think through how to be a student and what careers to try to shift into. I mean, people at the college were talking to those businesses that were left in town, trying to figure out where jobs would lie, trying to encourage these, you know, scared factory workers who are coming at the school to go into those fields. And a few years later, there just weren't enough jobs. And it's hard to, I mean, no amount of well-intended, competent retraining can compensate for a lack of jobs in the community.
You paraphrased the head of the Rock County Job Center, who believes that, quote, the shackle of big GM paychecks bred complacency and tethered people to the assembly line for 30 years or 40, for an entire working life, even if they hated the work. And there were people who said, I want to retire here, but I'm hating every day that I have to go in. So, I mean, there is that that dissonance between wanting that paycheck and yet feeling unfulfilled in those jobs.
That's absolutely the case from people that I've gotten to know in Janesville. There were, you know, when this all happened, people at the job center, people who were providing the retraining work thought, you know, this is going to be great. This is going to really free people to rethink what they want to be doing with their lives and their work. So there's a lot of optimism about that. It wasn't all borne out, but it was a very optimistic beginning, even though the loss of this number of jobs was quite traumatic. I mean, I think those two feelings of optimism and trauma coexisted for a while. But it's hard. I mean, I do know some people in town, including one family that I, you know, follow over several years in this book. The woman had been a high school dropout, and she had been working at the biggest supplier to the General Motors assembly plant. It was called Lear, and it was making seats for GM vehicles. And she was in her 40s at the time that all this work went away, and felt that her body really had been beaten up by the assembly line work. So she raced back to school, got a high school equivalency degree, went on to get an AA degree at this technical college, and then kept going and got a bachelor's degree. And she's working now with people who have developmental disabilities, and it's not paying her much, but she finds it really rewarding work. So that's happened to some people, that they've sort of found new identities, but not to everybody.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that your book points out. You know, we are putting your book and this episode in the context of a mini-series, if you will, on men out of work. And there are a lot of men in our society, 25 to 54, who are sidelined at this point. And we'd all like to think that this wonderful challenge of finding your way in a society and an economy that is changing so rapidly would be one of excitement and possibility and hope. But you remind us that reinventing oneself in midlife is not an easy thing to do.
It's not an easy thing to do, and it's really frightening. I mean, even for people who decided that they were going to go back to school and try to find a new new direction for themselves, you know, if you think about being a factory worker for, you know, decade or a couple of decades, it's been half your lifetime since you've been back at school, you might not have been a very good student in the first place. This is why you found factory work compelling. And you don't know where you're going to get the money to put dinner on the table. You've got kids. You've got responsibilities. You're trying not to lose your house, and then you're supposed to start studying. Well, that's a hard, hard thing to do.
Absolutely. And, of course, you remind us of the human toll that this has taken in the community of Janesville. You talk about students at Parker High start showing up for school hungry and dirty. You talk about the Parker Closet providing them with food and supplies. I mean, this is a position that so many people never thought they'd find themselves in.
Absolutely. I mean, when I think about what I set out to look at, it was really about what it's like to tumble out of the middle class for people who never expected that that would happen to them. And, you know, I think that you asked me a minute ago, you know, what I learned that I hadn't expected. I think one of the things that I really have learned out of this getting to know this community and writing about this community is that falling out of the middle class is very different than having grown up poor all along. And I know some of the high school teachers would tell me that, you know, kids who were poor because their families had always been poor, you know, it wasn't a good thing, but they knew how to do it. And these kids or these parents who suddenly found themselves out of the middle class, I mean, they were the ones who were really struggling emotionally.
You did not go out to do anything that was a polemic or talk about politics, but in the course of this, as you were studying the impacts on all the individuals in Janesville that you were able to talk to, you were talking about the arbitrary rules and the idiosyncrasies of government programs available to people as they are careening out of the middle class. You found them to be rather unusual, things that perhaps you had not been aware of before.
Well, one of the, you know, the book is, as we were talking about a minute ago, full of, you know, characters or people in town who had these various positions in which they were trying to figure out what to do. So one of the people who runs through the story is the guy who ran the job center. And, you know, he was somebody who had worked at the technical college and then was running the job center and really was trying to innovate and figure out how to leverage a lot of federal money to, as best he could, help the people in the ways that he thought they needed help. And he just repeatedly ran into, as you say, federal rules that made it hard. For instance, he was hoping that the county could start a program in which people could get paid while they were working at a business, an employer, while they were going back to school, so they could have sort of on-the-job training. And at the time, even though there was lots of federal retraining money coming from the Department of Labor in Washington, there wasn't any program that exactly let that happen. So that's just one example of the kinds of rules that, you know, may have made sense or may not have made sense in the macro level that when you look at it on the ground was a bit of an impediment.
You, of course, talking about a union town in demise. Do we really have things such as union towns any longer? Or is that one of the casualties of the changes that have occurred in America where in the private sector so few people are really part of a unionized group?
Well, the United Auto Workers, Local 95 is a local in Janesville that represented workers at the General Motors plant and a lot of the suppliers. It was a big force in town. And I'll tell you, I remember the first Labor Fest parade that I watched firsthand. It was in 2012. Janesville's always had a big Labor Day parade. Comes down Milwaukee Street, turns right onto Main Street. It's just a small city, big parade. And I kept waiting for the unit of UAW workers to march by. And I realized that the only thing that I was seeing were two retirees who were holding a banner between them, and that was it for the UAW in town. And I remember it was a, you know, hot late summer day, and just thinking, boy, there's no UAW unit marching in this parade in a city that had been all about the UAW.
Yeah. What does the town look like today, or at least when you stopped reporting on it, in terms of the diversity of the workforce, in terms of the diversity of industries and such? How different does it look? Is it all small shopkeepers as retail has taken over in many places for industry that has left? What does it look like?
Well, Janesville has a small, old downtown, the brickfront buildings, many of them are Victorian. And the downtown had been a little bit, you know, not completely decimated, but like a lot of places in the country, you know, a little bit depressed since the mall opened, you know, a few decades ago.
Yeah, we did a feature on that, yes.
Yeah, so that has stayed the case. It hasn't completely died, but it hasn't exactly revived. And one of the things that really just jumped out at me when I first started getting to know Janesville was how good it looks on the surface. I mean, there's a commercial drag called Milton Avenue, that runs north from downtown. And it's full of fast food places and stores because Janesville is, as it's always been, kind of a commercial hub for the farm areas around it. It's kind of where people come into town to go shopping. And some of those places have closed. I mean, there's been a Kmart that's closed. Some of the stores in the mall have closed. So it's not dead, but it's been losing business. It's gotten some business. The businesses that have arrived, for instance, there's a Dollar General distribution center that's going to be coming.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be offering wages of about $15, $16 an hour. And those are pretty good wages in town these days, maybe 300 or so jobs. But if you think about it, that's nothing like the $28 an hour that General Motors was paying when the plant closed at the end of 2008.
So if you were to go back to Janesville in 20, 30 years, looking at a generation that has had to adjust to all of these changes, what do you think you'd see?
I wonder about that. I mean, Janesville is, you know, as we've been discussing, the antithesis of place that when all this work went away, just kind of lay down and took it. I mean, it's been trying very hard to figure out how to restart its economy, and it's had little successes. But I think it's going to take years and years to know whether it can really rebuild or whether it's going to slowly attrit.
Well, thank you, Amy Goldstein, for this very, very beautiful portrayal of a community in crisis. And you have done so well by the cast of characters that you talk about at the beginning of the book and throughout the book. Janesville, an American story. and part again of a series about dislocation in our workforce. Thank you so much.
Pleasure to be with you.
If you like this episode, please leave us a kind rating or review. I'm on my hands and knees. Please do it on iTunes, because your review is really critical for us to continue providing this podcast. And John, I know that iTunes looks at this. They want to make certain that we have some rankings, some visibility, and that we're getting some traffic, and then they give you better positioning.
Absolutely. And this way, it'll put us in the forefront so you can find us much easier on your iPhone or Android, whatever you may be using.
And they may even send you out an alert. So please, if you can, don't miss a single episode of America Trends Podcast. And, John, they can subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher.com.
And also subscribe on our website.
Oh, absolutely.
We send out a little blurb, and we can also take your emails there at newsletter@rifkinradio.com. That's another way to get us.
And we do not sell or share
no
our
spamming,
lists.
No spamming, nothing.
Well, I don't know. Does anybody want our lists? I don't know, but we don't do it.
Good question.
Even if they asked us.
Even
nobody's
if they
asked us. But.
Right.
And when you do subscribe, let us know on Facebook and Twitter. We're getting very active on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle on both platforms, and John, this is really easy, at Trends Podcast. That's it.
That's real easy.
You like that? Did you get that?
I got that.
Okay.
I'm going to have to check it out now. I'm going to have to tweet it.
We want to thank you, of course, personally for subscribing. And we also would like to get some of your ideas and questions for future episodes of America Trends Podcast. And that's important, too, because we're all over the map. Our interest editorially in the future, John, has no bounds. But we want to know what it is that you'd like to hear from us, if there was a segment that you'd like to see us follow up on, or if there's something in depth that you'd like us to deal with. Please let us know that, too.
We're looking at the future. There's so much we can look at.
Yeah, and the topics that we've dealt with, I mean, we have gotten such incredible guests over the recent period, but they're only going to come to us if they know we've got an engaged and interactive audience.
Absolutely.
So it's really important that you become part of this podcast in so many different ways that we're sharing with you today.
You're absolutely right. We need your support and your help and your reviews.
And your ideas.
And ideas.
Or questions on Facebook and Twitter. And by the way, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using the hashtag Trends Podcast. You can also add an email address if you have a public one that you'd like us to give out.
Yeah, good. And you know what? You know what? We didn't mention Amazon.
Oh, yes. We have an Amazon store.
Yes.
And so if you go up, you don't have to buy the things that might be highlighted at that particular time. You can buy any book, and there's some benefit that comes back
just
to us.
Just put what you're looking at in the little search engine block there, and it'll take you right to Amazon, and it'll help us out.
Absolutely. And it doesn't really cost you anything more, because they have built that into their pricing structure. So we get a little taste, and you get more programming like this, and you get the item that you were looking for. So it works
Absolutely.
For all of us.
It's a win-win.
Absolutely. Win-win-win.
Win-win-win.
So for more information on America Trends and for the latest updates on upcoming episodes, be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can find us at Trends Podcast. And again, you can find John and I here in our studio performing as best we can for you.
That's right. And let us out.
What's that?
Let us out.
Let us out. No one is. Hey, listen, thank you so much for joining us today on America Trends. We'll see you next time.
We hope to hear from you soon.
Oh, by the way, we are posting all the time, and we're posting on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Good point.
So just be aware, if you're looking for new episodes, they're coming on Tuesdays and Thursdays. When you wake up, before you go out on your jog or your walk and you want to take us with you, we'll be there for you.
Very good.
All right. Have a great day.